Okay, let's go ahead and let's deal with that point of question in Matthew. No, I'll get it straight. Daniel 6. I'm in trouble. Now, if you look at the very end of chapter 5, it says, "And Darius the Median took the kingdom, being about 62 years old." And then we come into Darius the, sometimes pronounced Darius, but I've told Darius. And he's the main character, apart from Daniel, in chapter 6. If you look through Daniel, you will see that when, by the way, who succeeded the Babylonian Empire? If we're looking for our succession of empires, we start out with Babylon, that's the head of gold. We go to the chest of silver, and that's, help me out here. This is all important. This is major themes in Daniel. You got to keep this. Lock it in your head. This should be
Persia.
All right. But in Daniel, it is always referred to the kingdom of the Medes and Persians. Kingdom of Medes and Persians. Medes come first. And that is a clue. Understand that you are dealing with a confederate kingdom. They were two different small kingdoms that were allied with one another. We have a major character. We discussed him a little bit in the middle of the book of Isaiah. Toward the second half. A guy named Cyrus. Cyrus is the guy who made a decree that allowed the Israelites to go back and rebuild their temple at the end of the 70-year captivity. Cyrus was the first king of the Persian Empire. Now, let me be careful to say that Persian Empire, where the Persians had the primacy. Originally, the Medes had the primacy in the two groups. And let me back up also a little bit and say we have this character named Darius the Mede. If you were to go and look at almost all of your secular history books, I am careful in saying almost all of your secular history books, they will say there was no such guy. Didn't exist. But we have him mentioned here in Daniel, which tells us something. That means that he did exist. All right? Just because you can't find the guy's name somewhere in your digs and in your lists and so on doesn't mean he wasn't there. We discussed this when we were in chapter 5, dealing with a fellow named Belshazzar, that for a long, long time, Belshazzar was considered, they made it up. Now understand, Daniel, who knew these guys, he knew them enough to talk to them. All right? He was one of their ministers. He was there. He saw them. He talked to them. Do you think Daniel would know whether they were there or not? Does the guy exist? Well, if Daniel's talking to him and mentions him in his book, then yes, he did exist. And it's I think, a little presumptuous for folks that live 2,500 years later saying, nah, it never happened. Just because we don't have the data. Understand that there are only a handful, I mean literally a handful of documents that authenticate the existence of Julius Caesar. We have multiple copies of the same document, but there's only about four or five different sources that say he actually existed. All right? So, Medes and Persians. Who is Darius the Mede? Well, let's start out by saying what his name means. Which, something that is true with a number of kings, is that the name is also a title. All right? Christ is not Jesus' last name. Christ is his title. Christ is the Greek term for Messiah. All right? That Jesus is the Messiah. When you're saying Jesus Christ, you're saying Jesus the Messiah. Darius means holder of the scepter. Holder of the scepter. It is sometimes used as a title. It is sometimes used as a name. There were a number of later Persian kings that had this name. But that would be after the chronology that we're looking at here. This fella, for the time, was an older guy. He's 62 years old. I know that's not very old, but for the times, this is pretty old. And he is there in Babylon. Now, a couple of weeks ago, I mentioned two different Greek historians. I'm going to try to make this go fast so we can actually get into this part. I'm doing all this because if you come across books written by unbelievers or discussions like this, they'll jump on this. Daniel and Genesis are the two books that are under the most attack. Genesis because of origins. Daniel because the prophecy is so precise that if they can try to undermine the book, they will. Because it's so clearly, some historically, a lot of it's been fulfilled. And if they can say it was written after the fact, or if characters didn't exist, well, they tried that with Belshazzar and they got their fingers burned, but they're still doing it with Darius. All right. We're dealing with two different Greek historians. We have a fellow named Herodotus, or Herodotus, depending on who you talk to. And you have another guy named Xenophon. Okay? These guys wrote 100, 150 years after the fact. Okay, be like an American writing about the Spanish-American War. Everybody involved is dead. Everybody is gone. You can't interview anybody. They're all gone. What are you basing your information on? Traditions passed on. And if you can find them, pretty scarce in the day, papers, parchments maybe from some library. Not a whole lot of those. Inscriptions on different monuments and so on. All right. So traditions and monuments, that's what they're basing their history on. They don't have nearly as many resources as we would have today writing for about something that happened 150 years ago, writing about the Civil War, for example. These guys are both Greek. They're not Persian. Both of them had been there, however. They had traveled to that region and were familiar with the places, had seen some of the monuments. All right. This is the guy that everybody accepts for the most part today. And because these two guys have conflicting histories that are not reconcilable. This guy says things that this guy doesn't have. This guy says things that this guy doesn't have. And you can't reconcile the two. You know what that means? One of them is wrong. At least in the sections where there's conflict. The reason Herodotus is accepted is because you can't reconcile Herodotus with Daniel. Now, I'll be that blunt. Now, are there more ancient monuments and so on that agree with Herodotus than Xenophon? Yes. Are there some that agree with Xenophon? Yes. Now, let me also mention, by the way, Xenophon is reconcilable with the book of Daniel very, very easily. Fits like a glove. Now, I'm a Greek historian. I'm around between the year 400 and 350 BC. And I'm looking for information. And so I go to ancient Mesopotamia. And I go maybe to parts of what is now... So I'm going to Iraq and Iran. And I'm looking around at the rocks. I'm looking at the monuments, the things that, by the way... some of them were there then that are not there now, but a lot of them up until ISIS blew them up in the last few years were, you know, been there for a long time. All right. And you're going to go around and read the different things, and you're going to see what Cyrus said, because Cyrus said a lot of stuff. I want to let you in on something. That if you are reading what the Persians say about the Persians... It's all good. If you are reading what the Babylonians say about the Babylonians, it's all good from the Babylonian perspective. And the same thing is true regarding the Assyrians. The same thing is true regarding the Egyptians. All these guys write glowing accounts of themselves. Even when this guy here fought this guy in a war, they both won. It's amazing. No one lost. Or if they did, they don't talk about it. It's not there. Because in ancient times, they did the same thing that we do today. They used a whole lot of propaganda. We only tell good things about ourselves because we're great and wonderful. And we never lose. And we're the winners and we're the good guys. Cyrus was an expert at this. If you are the guy who is building a large empire, and he was, just as Nebuchadnezzar, even though his father, Nergalesser, was sitting on the throne in Babylon, who was the guy that was building the empire? Nebuchadnezzar was. He's the guy out there marshaling the armies. He's the one that's defeating the enemy and building this gigantic empire for his father, but it very soon came into his own hands. Cyrus is the field commander. He's out there building the empire. He is spreading all kinds of propaganda because when you're building an empire, you want to make your enemy look weak and you want to make the local people, come to the conclusion that their old master was a nasty guy and they're actually being privileged to be under the hand of the new guy. All right? Communists did that in Eastern Europe. The Nazis did that when they overran Europe. Japanese did that places they occupied. All right. Standard operating procedure for expanding empires. So Herodotus and Xenophon are going throughout and they're reading propaganda and they have to sort things out. All right. Which is not always easy because 90% of what they're reading is propaganda. And so they're going to come to different conclusions and they're going to record different things, frankly, because not all the documents are in accord with one another because they were written at different times and Cyrus is going to write different things or have different things written different places at different times to make different points. Okay? You follow what I'm saying? Here's the basic biblical history, the little window that we're looking at time-wise from Herodotus' perspective, and this is what most historians will accept today. Cyrus was a Persian. Probably true. Cyrus married he was the grandson of a Median king named Astyages. Astyages. This guy's a Median. This guy's a Persian. This guy is this guy's grandfather. By the way, Xenophon will tell you that was true. Okay, so far, we're in accord. No problems here. No conflicts with the Bible. This guy doesn't occur in the Bible, by the way. He's a Median Persian. Herodotus says that this guy betrayed this guy and defeated him in battle and took the whole thing. In other words, the Persians conquered the Medes. And that's how they ended up with a joint empire, with Cyrus as the head, because the Medes before were the dominant one, and now the Persians are the dominant one. Well, his mother is this guy's daughter. Okay? Evidently not. Now, this is Herodotus. This guy's an old man at this time. I mean, this guy's a grown man who's out fighting battles. Astyages is a pretty old guy at this time, according to Herodotus. He didn't kill him. He basically kept him under house arrest in a palace and let him enjoy his life till the end. But he wasn't in charge. Okay, that's Herodotus. And Cyrus comes in and he takes over, you know, Babylon and so on and so forth. I'll come back to that in a little bit because there's another option as well. All right. Okay. There's still Persians, there's still Medians. This guy has a son and a daughter. The daughter marries Cyrus's dad. So same situation that we have in Herodotus. This is Xenophon's take. But he also has a son who is an heir to the throne. And his name is Cyaxares. Cyaxares the second, because his father's name was Cyaxares. All right, we following this? Cyaxares the second. Don't worry about who Astyages' father was. It doesn't make a difference. He dies. Natural death, passes off the scene somehow or another, he's gone. This guy is head of the Medians, of the Medes. He is, therefore, this guy is his uncle. And because this guy is the field commander and he's doing great and wonderful things, to honor Cyrus, he gives his daughter to Cyrus as wife. So Cyrus marries his first cousin, his uncle's daughter. Cyaxares also has no sons. There's no heir to the throne. But he's got a son-in-law who's got lots of talent, is married to the princess, so Cyrus is going to inherit the throne. Cyrus is the field commander. This guy here, he's hanging out at Ecbatana, which is the capital of the Persians. He's hanging out in the palace while Cyrus is out there doing all the stuff. And after Babylon is taken, Cyrus tells his father-in-law, hey, why don't you, you're an older guy, and it's cold up there in the mountains of Ecbatana. Why don't you come on down to the plain where it's warm? Come on down to Florida. You can retire down here. You're still king. And you come on down here, and instead of ruling from the mountains in Persia where it's cold in the wintertime, you come down here to Babylon where it's warm year-round. And he does. Now, this is Xenophon. And Cyaxares comes down to Babylon. He stays there for 2 years, and then he dies. Natural causes. And then Cyrus inherits the whole kit and caboodle, and he's king of the whole show. Now, which one of those sounds more like propaganda? The first one does. The strong man. The other one is also a little more convoluted. This one is Xenophon's. The other one is Herodotus. This one, who is this guy? This guy is this guy. Because it fits. All you have to do is change his name. The guy fits. And Darius is a title, the holder of the scepter. Fits. Now, I will let you know there is another option. I think I have this on the last page. There's a little paragraph on the last page on your notes. And that is a guy named Gubaru, who actually has a couple of different names. He was the general who, because Cyrus actually didn't conquer Babylon himself. He wasn't there. Gubaru did. Gubaru was the one who came in and took the city. And he was made governor of Babylon, given a lot of authority. I'm not going to go into all the details as to why he was particularly favored, but he was. And he basically ruled as a client king in Babylon for about 14 years. Matter of fact, he outlived Cyrus. And some people have identified him as this guy as well. Cyaxares fits better. Both of them are possible. I'm letting you know this, that there are answers that fit with known history, and you don't have to say, oh, Daniel can't be true because it doesn't work. You got two guys that fit the bill. Either of them will work. I think Cyaxares is a better fit, but both of them will work. Because here you have the head king, even though this is the guy who's wielding the real power, he still recognizes him as the king, as his head, as his authority. So both these guys are existing at the same time. Just as Gubaru and Cyrus were also existing at the same time. Either one of them will work. I'm letting you know that there are historical characters that fit the bill that'll make the thing all fit together without doing any damage to Daniel. Okay? Okay, we just spent a half an hour talking about the first three words of verse 1. It pleased Darius, after he gets in there, this 62-year-old fella, he shows up there in Babylon, to set over the kingdom 120 princes, or satraps, which is kind of like a governor. Preservers of the kingdom is what the word means in Persian. By the way, there was 127 satraps under Ahasuerus and Esther. So you're dealing with the guy who is probably not just ruling Babylon, but the whole empire. Again, that's another argument in favor of it being Cyaxares. And over these, there were three presidents. That word president there is a unique word in the scripture. It only occurs here in this chapter regarding this particular office. And Daniel was evidently one of these. And he thought to elevate Daniel, who is now in his 80s, by the way, to be the head guy. Why does he want to elevate Daniel? Look at Daniel's history. Look at Daniel's ability to predict the future. All right. And look at Daniel's integrity. The man is blameless. You got a guy who is sharper than a tack, who is supernaturally able to foretell the future, and he is honest and forthright, and that's the guy you want. If you can combine brains and integrity, I mean, that's a scarce commodity. And you've got Daniel in both of those. It says in verse 3, then this Daniel was preferred above the presidents and princes because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king thought to set him over the whole realm. And the presidents and the princes sought to find occasion against Daniel concerning the kingdom. They are jealous. They want his job. They hate him. They hate him not because he's mean, because he's nasty or anything else. They are jealous. It's fascinating when you have... you couldn't pay me enough. There is not enough money in the world to send me to Washington, D.C., other than maybe as a tourist. Because these people all think they should be president. And you're dealing with a bunch of smarter than the average bear people that are all vying for this job, and they're all competing, and they're all seeking to discredit one another instead of working together for the country. Instead, they're, and it's always been this way. You go back and read what happened in Andrew Jackson's administration. It was the same thing. All right? What was going on in John Adams' administration? It was the same thing. Frankly, it was going on in Washington's administration, except everybody revered Washington. They weren't after Washington. They were after each other because they wanted to be the next. Washington, he can be the first. That's fine. All right. But I want to be second. Now, nothing's changed. You go to any country in the world, it works the same way and has throughout history. People are power hungry. And you don't get to this level by just sitting around twiddling your thumbs. You're an ambitious guy and you want this. You want this, you want this. And so you get all these people that are pursuing that level. And so they are trying to discredit, they're trying to find some scandal. They're trying to find something on Daniel. This guy's been around for a long time. We've got to be able to find something. And so they're on the net and they're looking through the web pages and they're checking the blogs and they're going through all of his emails and they're checking everything they possibly can to try to find some dirt on Daniel. And they come up empty. Absolutely empty. It says they could find none occasion nor fault, for as much as he was faithful, neither was any error or fault found in him. Man, how'd you like to be like Daniel? So, how are we going to get Daniel? We're going to have to create something. We're going to have to fabricate something, but we're going to have to blend it with some truth so it has teeth. And so they say in verse 5, we shall not find any occasion against this Daniel except that we find it concerning the law of his God. Now, two things. Number one, Daniel's not going to deviate from the law of God. He's already demonstrated that. And also, the law of Daniel's God is different than everything else in the kingdom. Daniel is an oddball. He is a standout. He does things and practices things and believes things that the rest of us don't. The rest of us are a bunch of heathen pagans that are party animals, and here you've got this straight-laced fella who honors the God of heaven. And so we're going to try to find something tied to his God, the worship of his God, or something that we're going to be able to use against him. So these folks get together. By the way, don't think it was the 120. All right? It was probably a sampling of these, the high mucky mucks that are trying to promote themselves. Then these presidents and princes assembled together to the king. Aha, we have our plan. And they said unto him, King Darius, live forever. Okay, we've already been through that standard operating procedure, approach, address when you're dealing with royalty. And then they say something that isn't true. all the presidents of the kingdom. Now, where does this, how big is this kingdom? Let's see. Iran, Iraq, Turkey, Syria, Lebanon, Israel, Jordan, parts of Saudi Arabia. By this time, it might be including Egypt. It's a big piece of territory. All right. Not everybody is in accord. How do we know that? Because they can't talk to them. They don't know. All right. All they know is we want to bump off this guy, but we're going in with a plan. And because the king can't refute what we're saying either. All right. We're just going to tell him that this is the case. Now remember, the king, if he's Syaxes II, is in semi-retirement. All right. So he's living the good life. He's there in Babylon. He's enjoying himself. He gets to do king stuff. And he doesn't have to worry about a lot of the really big stuff because Cyrus is out there dealing with the armies and all the other stuff. But he's secure there in Babylon, and so he's taking it easy. And he's being deceived here in this situation. He's not a total dope. I mean, you don't get to be king and live to this age by being a total dope. But I think he's had his guard down. And they said, we've done a consultation, and everybody says that we should have consulted together to establish a royal statute to make a firm decree that whosoever shall ask a petition of any god or man for 30 days, save unto thee, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. Everything has got to come through you. Anything official, any prayer, anything has got to come through you. Because we love you so much, and we want to show you this level of honor. And he can see him going, yeah, all right, I like this. This is pretty good. I mean, after all, it can't be too offensive. This isn't life-changing. This is just for a month. You know, this, and everybody can go back to normal, but you know, hey, I'll take the honor I can get. The Persians, by the way, were not big in deifying themselves, like the Romans later were. But, some of the others were. The Egyptians did this. There were some of the other cultures that did this. And so to dabble in it for a month or so, I can deal with that. Yeah, this is stroking his ego. Things that are done to stroke an ego are very self-destructive. Why was Absalom defeated in 2 Samuel? A decree of God, but humanly speaking, why was Absalom defeated? Ahithophel gave him great advice. And the scripture says it was great advice. But he didn't follow Ahithophel's advice. Instead, he followed Hushai's advice. And Hushai, smart guy. Now, remember, he's David's closet ally. Hushai is. Ahithophel, here's his good advice. King, because I'm recognizing you're the king. King, let me go do this, and I will do this, and we'll do this, and we'll do this, and we'll do this, and the kingdom will be yours. And Hushai says, this is not good advice. I think, Absalom, that you ought to do this, and 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 then everything will be fine. Ahithophel says, we'll do this, I'll take care of this. Hushai says, you do this, and you do this. Stroked his ego, and he fell. Arrogance is dangerous, it's self-destructive. And so they say in verse 8, now, O king, establish the decree, sign the writing, that it be not changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which altereth not. We see this in the book of Esther as well. You think, why in the world did they do this? It's stupid. Why? I mean, why can't a king, if a king realizes he made a dumb mistake, why can't he go back and fix it? Because, folks, kings don't make mistakes. Kings don't make mistakes. I said what I said. And if he's inside going, oh man, why did I don't make mistakes. And that's why they have that kind of thing. Again, it's an ego thing. It's a self-destructive thing, but it's an ego thing. And so these guys, knowing that once a decree is signed, once the signet has been pressed into the wax, the king is stuck. He cannot undo it. Now, he can make another decree that might water down or limit the first decree. That's what they did in Esther. But they can't make a decree that will say, I'm sorry, the first one doesn't work anymore. So they make the decree. He signed the writing and the decree, verse 9. Now, when Daniel is a sharp guy. Daniel's astute. He knows exactly what his enemies are doing. He knows why they're doing it. A public proclamation is going to go out, and he hears the public proclamation. He's like, well, they did it. Now, is Daniel going to alter his behavior for the 30 days? No. Daniel is in this position not because of what Daniel can get. Daniel is in this position to be a testimony for the God of heaven. He has been faithful. He has been faithful since his teen years. He is now in his 80s. Your testimony is a valuable thing. Daniel could have chucked it all here at the end. People would have forgotten the 70 years of faithfulness and so on because of a trip up at the end. And so Daniel knew that the writing was signed. He went to his house, and his window was open in his chamber toward Jerusalem, and he kneeled upon his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks unto his God as he did aforetime. He changed nothing. He was not doing it for show. He was doing exactly what he did beforehand, and they knew that that's what he did. Can you imagine if they got spies on other high roofs watching, looking through the windows of his upper chamber? Because they're used to being able to see him in there. And if he doesn't show up, they're going to say something. Either he found out, but they're also going to say, see, he isn't really that faithful. Now, humanly speaking, this is a lose-lose. My integrity, my testimony is extremely important. I can't back down. But if I don't back down, I'm going to be thrown into the den of lions. So what do I do? Am I going to maintain my integrity and become cat food, or am I going to back down and keep my position? Well, in reality, which one is more important? Well, the one he chose, because he knew. And so the men assembled. I always envision this as they showed up there at his house, and they're all standing there gathered around watching him pray. Now, they were probably in a house across the street or something like that, looking in, and he got a bunch of them gathered together so they could all be eyewitnesses and say, we saw him. We saw him. Daniel's a high enough official. They can't be barging into his house. They found Daniel praying and make a supplication before his God. They came near and spake before the king concerning the king's decree. These guys were also over-anxious because they're going to press it so hard that the king is going to be able to figure it out that, hey, wait a minute. I've been duped. Okay, when that happens, the guys who are seeking to ingratiate themselves and gain rises to power and authority have just pulled the rug out from underneath themselves and they don't know it. But they're over-anxious. So, they've got Daniel, and they come in, they say, have you not signed a decree that every man that shall ask opinion of any god or man within 30 days save thee, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? The king answered and said, the thing is true according to the law of Medes and Persians, so alter it not. Isn't that great? He's still reveling in the thing. Then they answered and said, because it was the same day. Same day. They don't wait on this at all. They could have waited 2 weeks and still accomplished their purpose. But they're over-anxious. They know they've got Daniel, and they don't want to wait. They want to nail him. They answered and said that Daniel, and by the way, they're going to try to demean him by saying, which is of the children of the captivity of Judah. He is not a Babylonian. He is not a Persian. He is not a Mede. Instead, he's one of these lowly Jews over here from the captivity. By the way, they did the exact same thing to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in chapter 3. He regardeth not thee, O king. He's not obeying your law, nor the decree that thou hast signed, but maketh his petition 3 times a day. This is almost exactly the same phrasing as the accusers had against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Now, Nebuchadnezzar, it says, then was his visage changed. This one, the king, when he heard these things, was sore displeased. And he's not sore displeased with Daniel. he realizes he's been had. And the guy that he trusts, the guy he wants to have, give the reins of government to, the guy that he is gonna actually, cause when you've got an honest guy who is very, very capable, what does that do for the king? It makes his life a lot easier. If I've got a bunch of wicked, scheming people, I have got to keep my eye on them, and I have to have my spies in place to make sure that these people are not doing other intrigues. It becomes a lot of work for the king. If I've got a guy who is capable and honest, it makes it easier. The king is sore displeased with himself. And set his heart on Daniel to deliver him, and he labored until the going down of the sun to deliver him. Now, understand, culture of the time, speedy trial meant that day. You're guilty, and the sentence carried out same day. All right? Find out the crime has been committed. Here's the witnesses. He's guilty. Execution. All done. Execution has to be carried out that day. He waits till sunset. That's the official end of the day. The king is putting off the inevitable, and he's probably huddled together with a bunch of Persian lawyers to see if there's any way around this. Or is there any way that we can frame a decree that will allow me to let Daniel off somehow? And they can't come up with anything. The enemies there have phrased everything just so that there isn't any wiggle room. Then these men assembled together in their over-anxiousness, in verse 15, and said to the king, "Know, O king, that the law of the Medes and Persians is that no decree or statute which the king hath established may be changed. You're stuck. We got you." Again, these guys are hurting themselves, and they don't know it. Because even if Daniel is fed to the lions, and he actually gets fed to the lions, what's going to keep these guys from suffering down the road? Now, granted, the king does need capable people in place. But it doesn't mean that he's going to trust them and leave them there for any length of time. So it's a dangerous thing to do what these guys are doing. People who are over-anxious in going after somebody else will often find themselves at the end of the rope when the day is over. The king commanded, he is bound by the law. And they brought Daniel, and they cast him into the den of lions. Now, den of lions. Lions, at this time, were found from India to South Africa, from the Atlantic coast of Africa to all across the northern part of Africa, throughout the Middle East, up through and including Turkey and in Greece, Bulgaria, Romania. That whole area there was lion habitat at this time. There are still lions in India. There's about 200 to 400 of them. They're still there in western India, and they are not from Africa. They are native Indian lions. There's still a holdout there. And if you were to put an African lion here and an Indian lion here and look at them and then put the walnut shells over them and shuffle them around and then lift the shells, you probably couldn't tell which one was which. Probably. Den of lions. You've got a... It's down below. Now, remember, we're in Babylon. There's no caves. Some of the commentators are talking about caves and stuff. Yeah, we're talking about a big flat plain. So what you've got is you've got something. Imagine two rooms about the size of this room. Okay? With a doorway. May have been this size, may have been a little bit wider. Connecting the two. You got 20-foot walls. And a ceiling over the whole thing. This thing is, now, on the side, probably in both rooms, you've got another door on the side. It's got great big wrought iron bars. All right? Lions can't get through it or anything. And what you do, why two rooms? Because under the palace, you don't want to have a dirty cat box. So what you do is you throw a few prisoners or goats or whatever over here. All the lions run in there and clang! The gate drops down. And then the guys come through this door and clean the big cat box. And then once they're done over here, they wait a day or two, and they repeat the process, and they probably had a regular routine keeping the thing clean. Up above, you got a couple of big manhole covers. Probably about 4 or 5 feet across, maybe more. And depending on the circumstances, that's where the prisoners come from. You drop them down there. And how do you make sure that the lions are going to dispose of the prisoners? Starving. Well, you keep them close to starvation. Can I tell a story on our cat? When we got our cat, I'm going to tell a story on your sister is what it is. We have learned the cat, when it wants to be fed, is very vocal. And I think your sister had learned this a long time ago. So what she did is she kept the cat's bowl always full. And so when we got this cat, which is a medium-sized cat as far as frame is concerned, the cat weighed like 23 pounds. She was a melon with legs. And we determined that we are going to make this cat healthy. The cat couldn't even clean itself. It was so fat. And so we put the cat on a diet. And she gets wet food in the morning, and she gets wet food in the evening, and that's all she gets. And we've gotten her down to what? 14 pounds probably? Something like that. She's still chunky, but she's not, wow, what a fat cat! Or she's not like that. But I'll tell you what, in the morning, thump, 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 meow, 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 until somebody goes out there and either throws her in the garage or feeds her. If it's me, she goes out to the garage. And then at 6 o'clock, and it actually starts before then, we get the same thing. All right? Now, the cat is not starving, but she wants food. All right? If you keep the thing well fed, it's not going to bother anybody. All right? Why is it that the fish at the aquarium don't eat each other in the big communal tank? Because they feed them a lot. All right? And they don't bother each other. If you were to hold back a little bit, there would be fewer fish in the aquarium. All right? So, you're feeding them enough to keep them reasonably healthy because, after all, I need lions to do what the lions are doing. But I don't want to feed them too much because I need them to do what lions are doing. So they bring Daniel, and probably as a courtesy, they lowered him by ropes down through the manhole cover on the top. I don't think they're going to throw him down to 20 feet and have him crash into the straw that's down there in the bottom. So they bring him. And the king commanded, and they brought Daniel, cast him into the den of lions. They said, and he said, now the king spake and said unto Daniel, thy God whom thou servest continually, he will deliver thee. Does he know this? Wishful thinking on the part of this guy. He may be familiar with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, but that was a long, long, long time ago. Plus, this guy's a Median and not a Babylonian. So he may be familiar with that, he may not. But he feels awful. Plus, frankly, he's a wicked, nasty, cruel, and vicious pagan king. I think he's much more interested in the fact that he's been duped, and the guy that would make his life easier is about to get bumped off, and he doesn't like this scenario. And he wants it reversed. So the king makes that statement. And the stone was brought and laid upon the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet and the signet of his lords. Because then the reason they did that with the guys who were accusing Daniel, because that way the king couldn't break the seal, get Daniel out, and sneak back in and put his own signet in there. He's got people that are confirming that. Several different signets on that seal. That the purpose might not be changed concerning Daniel. Daniel is in the lion's den. Now, it doesn't say has to be fed to the lions, that the lions have to eat him. This is kind of like guy has to be hanged. And they used to have to add to this, hanged until dead, because there were some guys that could sit there like this, and they could last a little bit, and you've got some sympathetic people say, all right, cut him down. And the guy would go, and he'd survive. Well, they didn't say that the lions had to eat him. They didn't figure that too many guys managed to survive this. Stone was brought. The king went to his palace, passed the night with fasting. Major meal of the day was usually at dark, especially for the royalty. Neither were instruments of music brought for him. His sleep went from him. He's thinking about this. It's bothering him. We're talking about that this morning in the Sunday school hour. Things on his mind. Things on his mind. Can't get over it. Thinking about it. The king rose very early in the morning. I doubtful whether he had slept at all anyway. He's looking at the first opportunity, the sunbreak. Daniel was thrown in there. The decree was fulfilled. He spent the night there. It is daybreak. He goes back in haste. And he came to the den. And they pulled the stone away. And he says with a lamentable voice unto Daniel, "Is thy God, whom thou servest continually, able to deliver thee from the lions?" Wishful thinking. Can you imagine? I would love to have seen the guy's face when he hears verse 21. "Then said Daniel unto the king, O king, live forever. My God has sent his angel and has shut the lions' mouths, and they have not hurt me, for as much as before him, before God, innocency was found in me, and also before thee, O king, have I done no hurt." I'm innocent. I have done no crime. He was actually probably much more comfortable than Darius was. I mean, he's got these big, warm, fuzzy mattresses and blankets to snuggle up next to. Then the king was exceedingly glad for him and commanded they should take Daniel up out of the den. So they lower the rope down there and they pull him up. And so Daniel was taken out of the den, and no manner of hurt was found on him because he believed in his God. And the king goes from this. Now, the over-anxious enemies of Daniel, they got themselves in trouble. They were lining up their trouble in advance of all this. And so the king commanded, it's all very quick here in verse 24, the king commanded, and they brought those men which had accused Daniel, quite a crowd of them, and they cast them into the den of lions, their children and their wives. That was standard operating procedure for the Persians. If a man committed a capital crime, his whole family went. The Greeks and the Romans used to think that the Persians were horribly cruel and very, very firm and vicious in their laws. And that's coming from the Greeks and the Romans. And it says, and the lions had mastery over of them and break all their bones in pieces wherever they came from the bottom of the den. They didn't bother Daniel, not because they weren't hungry. It says, "My God hath sent his angel." And so you got these, we don't know how, there's probably a couple of dozen lions down there, at least. And they're dropping the people down there one by one. And you know how a cat is with a toy on the end of a string. Well, that's what's happening with these people as they get thrown in there one by one. Crunch and munch. And now we have the decree. This guy's learning lessons. Remember, he only lives for about another 2 years. And we don't know anything more of Darius' education, but it looks like that he learned a lesson that Nebuchadnezzar, or at least is learning the lesson that Nebuchadnezzar learned. Because he makes a decree. Verse 26, "That in every dominion of my kingdom men shall tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God and steadfast forever in his kingdom, that which shall not be destroyed. His dominion shall be even unto the end." Some of the things that Nebuchadnezzar was mentioning at the end of chapter 4. "He delivereth and rescueth, and he worketh signs and wonders in heaven and in earth, and hath delivered Daniel from the power of the lions." Bang, there we go. And then we have this little bit of history. "So this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian." Now, you got two possibilities here. These guys are either reigning concurrently, or in succession. And it doesn't matter because the two scenarios that I gave you, both of them will work for this one. If we are dealing, however, with succession, that means that Daniel is going to be prospering for at least 2 more years. And if I remember right, there's one of the prophecies that takes place that happens in the 3rd year of Cyrus. So we got stuff that's still going to be going on later. Daniel's going to be around for at least 3 more years in his service there. So, Any questions or comments on what we see here in chapter 6? And like I said, you read on this, chapters, you got 28 verses. What is everybody fixated on? Who's this guy? Why are they fixated on that? Because we are trying to discredit the book. Never mind the lessons we can learn. And what's ironic is we talked about chapter 5 when they were denying the existence of Belshazzar and then they got their fingers burned. What is happening in our storyline in this chapter? Over-anxious people getting it in the end. All right? We got all these people. Darius never existed. Darius never existed. Darius never existed. I'm just waiting for somebody to find something in some hole in the ground, someplace in the Middle East, and all of a sudden, we were mistaken. Oh, well, let's change the subject. Because in the long run, not the conclusions of the archaeologists, but the actual data is the Bible believer's friend. Okay? The more they dig up, all it does is say, you know, it was right all along. What do you know? It was right all along. What do you know? It was right all along. You know why? Because it's right all along. All right. Let's close in prayer. Father, thank you for your word. Father, thank you that it is trustworthy. And Father, thank you for lessons we can learn from the lives of people. May we be a Daniel. May we be faithful. And Father, we are surrounded by a wicked world filled with wicked people that are doing wicked things. And Father, may we not be party to it. May we not be participants in that. And may we do what's right, even if it costs us. We pray for Christ's sake. Amen.